welcome to episode 53 of the Extra Sequential podcast hosted out of Perth, Western Australia. My name's Mladen.
My name is Chris, and we are going to be talking about comics and pop culture goodness.
Fantastic.
General stuff.
Anything in particular this episode, Chris?
No, we're just going to fly off the seat of our pants.
That's a lie.
No, we are going to be talking about books, two OGNs, original graphic novels, that could not be more different, really.
Yeah, I know.
When I think about it.
Comics of a theme.
Yeah. What, there's a theme?
No.
Oh, no, there
isn't. There's no theme at all.
They're basically just two new comics. So one is from Gestalt Publishing called The Deep, about undersea adventurers, and the other one is also about adventurers.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, I suppose that's a theme. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the latest book in that, called Century 1969 by the bearded Alan Moore and the, I don't know if he's bearded, Kevin O'Neill.
Maybe they've got a caricature of themselves in the inside cover. They tend to do that with League.
Yeah, that's true. Not in this one, but...
Yes.
So we'll be talking about those two books as well as the news and general shenanigans in the world of pop culture stuff.
So, Chris, how was your excursion to Sydney?
Yes, I've just come back from Sydney a couple of days ago. Just had a holiday there, just on my lonesome, and it was quite good. I basically just went over there to do some creative writing. Which I didn't do much of, I must admit, but I kind of transferred the contents of my various notebooks over the years to my lovely Mrs. Mac.
My lovely Mac. Very good.
So I've started just transferring that over, and then I've looked at, there's a, I think it's called Scrivener or Script or something. It's a script writing program that you can buy off the Apple Store that a lot of screenwriters and writers have recommended. So I'm going to look at that. It's basically... Because the problem I have is when you're writing, you've got bits and pieces all over the place, and I don't really put them into subjects. So I've got a bit of dialogue here, a scene there, character description here. So this kind of allows you to put it all in different, and it's the way it's organized is quite good. So I'm going to look at doing that. But yeah, it was a good holiday.
Yeah,
saw a couple of flicks.
Thanks for bringing back some nifty gifties.
Yes, I did. I went to the two comic shops, two very different comic shops, actually. One is King's Comics in Sydney, which is very clean and neat and tidy. Had uniformed staff and well-lit, very nice. And the other one was completely different, Comic Kingdom, which is mainly just specializes in the older comics, and that was basically just opposite my hotel. And it was... it's a two-story place, and it's kind of like a swap meet in a retail outlet. It's like just stuff everywhere, and there's like VHS cassettes on steam trains.
Wow.
And like, you know, a 1990 Starlog magazine talking about the latest Indiana Jones or whatever.
Wow. Okay.
Next to, you know, FHM and girly magazines, and but the latest comics and stuff as well, and, you know, Happy Meal figurines lining the walls. And very, very odd place, but it's the kind of place where it's obviously got a lot of personality. So, so I was flicking through the stuff to see what I could find for you and me. And, I got you a couple of...
children's comics?
Walt Disney things from... They're almost as old as me, 1979.
Really?
Oh, and one was an Animaniacs horror anthology.
Yes.
And the other one was a Bernie Wrightson anthology from the 80s.
Thank you very much. So, I got you like a $2 creators writing on Fantastic Four book. I saw it and thought of you, and I thought, you're worth $2.
I sure am. Is that GST inclusive?
Yeah, I'll forward you the tax receipt. You can claim it.
Well, perhaps you can talk about those comics one day in some form.
Hey, that's a good idea.
Because I was flicking through them, I must admit, and they look pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of moving house, so my
It'll
ability to grab comics at random is going to be challenging. So maybe I'll just focus on web comics for...
The foreseeable future.
For a few.
Well, you could write on your boxes and be quite precise.
Of which books are in there.
Yeah.
That's getting into like insane man territory.
Well, you're unemployed.
Let's get into the show. Okay. Quick correction on last week's show, and I thought this was worth pointing out. Not all furries are into the sexually explicit material. It's just anthropomorphic animals.
Enough.
And I think that's a fair enough correction. My mistake.
That's very humble and noble of you. when it comes to sex, I think that both of us can say we don't know much.
It's very good.
But especially me.
Oh, yeah, and I think Jenny from the Extra Sequential site said, we forgot about Pride of Baghdad, which is a famous cats comic.
And we did talk about it, I'm sure, before we started the show. But
we can't take credit for it. We didn't mention it on the show.
But we didn't mention it on the show.
It's not on audio. It never happened.
No. There's no record. It's like the Watergate tapes or whatever. The missing 8 minutes. Or whatever.
Never happened. Blah, blah, blah. That was my Richard Nixon.
Oh, I thought it was your Scooby-Doo. let's talk about the news.
Okay.
So I had noticed something again for you. I seem to be thinking about you a lot lately.
This again.
I need a girlfriend. The Annotated Sandman Volume 1, which is in the current previews, in the DC Comics section, page 132, actually. And this is kind of cool. It's a 560-page black and white trade paperback collecting the first 20 issues of Sandman, the classic 80s to 90s. Did it stretch into 2000? I don't think it did.
No.
Kind of Vertigo horror supernatural series by Neil Gaiman and a whole bunch of different artists. And it's written by Leslie Klinger. I don't know if she's related to the guy from MASH. But it's basically...
Jamie Farr.
Hours of... apparently she had hours and hours of conversations with Neil Gaiman. And this is basically an annotated panel by panel description of what this man... people have done that with Alan Moore's work, Legend of Extraordinary Gentlemen in particular.
That's been online, so this is interesting that they're selling it.
Yeah, I guess because Sandman has such a rabid fan base that they'll eat this stuff up. So,
and Seacott did a annotated Invisibles for Grant Morrison's
that's
work.
True. Yeah. Yep. And I think Comics Alliance did one on Grant Morrison's Batman work as well. So it's not written by Neil Gaiman, and it's just black and white reprints of the actual individual issues. So I guess if you already own the colour ones, this would be something. So, 560 pages. So it's in the current previews catalogue now, so it'll come out in 2 months' time. So that's, October, just in time for Halloween.
Okay. I've got a piece here. Chris, can you stretch your memory back into the vast, vast depths of last week's show, where we discussed Dan Didio's somewhat venomous response to a questioner at the DC Comics panel, and then their
later apologetic of, and yes.
Yeah, we hear you, you know, we got the message, people, and we're going to do our best. And so this week, as part of that, in that spirit, they announced that the new female character is going to be the White Rabbit, who basically is dressed like a Playboy bunny, one of the girls at the mansion. Basically nothing except bunny ears. Probably she's got a cotton bud on her butt and very little else.
This is a new Batman villain, I believe.
Yes, for the new relaunch. And so what does this say? Does this say, we hear you, but it sounds like, wah, you cry babies?
This would have been done months in advance before the outcry about the lack of female creators and strong characters in DC Comics. So I'd imagine, hopefully... by this time next year, there'll be a plethora of strong female characters and hopefully creators.
It's interesting. They could have picked maybe another week to release this press release about
the new... It's a bit odd timing, isn't it?
And so the theory is she'll be another Alice in Wonderland villain for Batman.
Yeah, and there's already one in Batwoman.
There's a million of
them.
So,
yeah, I don't know why.
So he has the Carpenter, Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and of course Mad Hatter. What?
And Humpty. Oh, no, Humpty Dumpty. That's a nursery rhyme, isn't it?
No, there is a Humpty Dumpty.
There is, but it's not a he's in Lewis Carroll.
No, he's in Arkham Asylum. They just use the name, but he tries to put things back together and ends up doing Frankensteinish creations by accident, even though he means well. Wow, so for some reason, Alice in Wonderland and Batman go well, but this has seemingly nothing to do with the White Rabbit of the kind of waistcoat wearing, ooh, I'm loot. Instead, it's a Playboy bunny. So,
yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say.
DC hates women again. Maybe they'll issue another apology letter. This time, we really mean it.
Well, maybe she'll die in the end of the issue and that'll be the end of it.
Wishful thinking. Robert Crumb recently announced that he will not be attending Graphic in 2011, that's an Australian arts and
head
popular
Head of the Sydney Opera House, yes.
Yeah, that's right. After he read an article in the Daily Telegraph, which described him as a self-confessed sex pervert. And
a warped human being who possesses a sick mind by Hetty Johnson, who apparently is some...
anti-child abuse campaigner I've got here.
Okay.
And she was using him as a platform. There's a quote here, sick and deranged... And demonizing Crumb's work as perverted images emanating from what is clearly a sick mind.
Yes.
I feel bad for Crumb, and the impression I got for why he cancelled is because he's probably well familiar with how a little bit of negative press in the mainstream media can lead to some very ugly appearances in public in that.
Yeah, well, do we want to explain who Crumb is, first of all?
I think it's assumed.
He's an underground comics kind of, I guess, the godfather of underground comics and Mr. Natural and all those.
But from now on we have to explain who Stan Lee is every time. And come on, these are big figures in the world of comics.
Well, surely. Stan Lee is.
He's a Mount Rushmore figure.
He's much more known than Robert Crumb, but yes. And what I found interesting is reading the comments on this. He's 67. He lives in France. Some people saying, yeah, it's fair enough. He's probably had enough with dealing with all the loose Western... the non-loose Western morals when it comes to depiction of sexuality. And some people saying, well, come on, how can he deprive our fans and let people down? He just needs thicker skin. What does he care what people think about him? Just come on down. It's only one person.
Yeah.
And they're right. You know, it's so far, it's just this only one woman. But I guess... And it doesn't help Australia's case because we're always banning musicians and artists and people for this, that, and the other. It doesn't make us look good either.
But it's a long flight. So Rob was probably like, oh,
that's true, it is.
Thank God.
From France. Yeah.
But he was saying it was strong stuff and it made me look very, very bad. All it takes is a few people who overreact to something like that to show up and cause unpleasantness. I have a lot of anxiety about having to confront some angry sexual assault crisis group. So I get it.
I guess he doesn't want to face misinformed people who have never...
What's Australia known for overseas? Cronulla riots? Being a backwards convict colony.
Yep.
So maybe it's part of those things.
Whatever the trees they can glean from that Simpsons episode.
What else have you got in news?
There's going to be a new Thor.
Again?
Apparently, maybe.
Is he half black, half Latino?
No, that's Spider-Man. After the in November's Mighty Thor number 8, there'll be a new Thor called Tamarus, T-A-M-A-R-U-S. Marvel has just... Mere hours ago released a teaser image, which Marvel like to do. Thor is, it looks like he's either going to die or be stripped of his powers or something, because in the current Fear Itself miniseries that's got everybody involved, all the superheroes involved, Thor and his dad Odin are having a big fight and a whole bunch of stuff is happening. So this Tamarus guy, we don't know much about him. We know what he looks like, and we'll put the picture online. But so if you're a fan of Thor, not a fan of Thor, but a fan of Thor, in November, pick up Mighty Thor 8. Thor has been replaced quite a few times, as has every superhero over the decades, so this won't be the first or last time.
But there'll be an uproar of people who haven't read Thor in 30 years. How dare you change Thor, Fantastic Thor?
Well, he's an alien, I think, this guy, so at least there's no race issues or sex issues.
Do you reckon there'll be people confusing him with the Fantastic Four in, like, say, news media or whatever?
No.
They're swapping the Fantastic Four for some Viking guy. All right.
What else you got news-wise?
Hey, that's it, baby.
Yeah, that's all I got too.
Yeah, kind of a quiet week, which is great because it gives us time to talk about these two comics.
Okay, then.
Are there be dragons?
Here be dragons, actually.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, you're
don't correct
flying
my
star.
Pirate.
Oh. So we're talking about the deep colon. Here be dragons.
Deep colon.
Oh, boy. From Gestalt Publishing, which is a local Perth... Are they Perth's only comic?
Zines don't count, do they? Like,
I'm sure there's guys with photocopiers and...
Yeah.
Actually, no, there's not, because there are, like, I know both Quality Comics and Comic Zone have a shelf dedicated to...
Yeah, just local press stuff, but it's all just one... It's not a publishing company, per
no,
se.
No, that's true. Gestalt's perhaps the best. Well, obviously the best and most professional. Anyway.
And we've reviewed them before on the show. Digested...
Rombies.
Rombies, of course.
The Example, which is awesome. So this is written by the same guy that did a lot of their work, Tom Taylor, who's also writing Star Wars at the moment and some other stuff, with art by a first-timer, James Brewer. I'm not quite sure how to say that name. But he's got a very kind of... loose animated kind of style.
Yep.
So this is a 88-page full-color original graphic novel. It was out now. It was released a couple of weeks ago. And it basically focuses on the Necton, N-E-K, N-E-K-T-O-N, Necton family. So they're like a nuclear family, mum, dad, son, and daughter. That's what a nuclear family is.
But not your average family.
You sound like you're some 80s sitcom or something. So you've got obviously a mum, dad, aunt, short for Antius, his fish, Jeffrey, goldfish, and his sister, their daughter, Fontaine. And they basically just travel around the world in their sub Aranax, which I'm sure it probably has meaning. Maybe it's a Jules Verne carrot or something.
It could be a cool Greek name. Or,
yeah. So it opens with this big wave opening in Greenland, and then the basically the family, being the undersea adventurers that they are, decide to kind of investigate what's happening and why it's happening. The father, who's like this big, tall, beefy guy, he's interesting because he's not what you'd consider a scientist type. He looks more like Tom Cruise's bodyguard or something.
Kind of Vin Diesel looking.
Yeah, Vin Diesel would be good. He was in The Iron Giant, Vin Diesel.
Yes, he was. He was quite good in that. He made me cry. Yeah. Or he's got like a Dwayne. He's the even Rock raising Johnson. An eyebrow in one panel here. Yeah, that's true. He's got like a Dwayne Johnson.
Smell what the Rock is cooking. So they basically go to Greenland after the father discovers this old map and kind of does some interpreting and discovers that indeed this old text says here be dragons. So they go off on a bit of a whirlwind adventuring and meet a rather ditzy blonde reporter who they don't kind of like. He's kind of like the reporter in Die Hard. He's kind of like nosy and gets in everybody's way.
Yes.
But the female equivalent and this kind of great stereotypical old fisherman who could be out of like a Popeye comic or something, and he thinks he's got this kind of theory that these big sea creatures come back every few decades. So it's pretty good. I mean, not a lot happens necessarily. There's not heaps of action. There's not like big fights with massive sea monsters and stuff, but it's very dialogue and character driven book. Mm-hmm. There are big sea creatures in it.
Yeah, I think the main conflict is the family kind of gets captured inside the belly of a
mighty beast.
A mighty beast.
Which is always inconvenient.
And it's up to the wisecracking young and aunt.
Yes. To save the day.
And his plucky sidekick fish pet.
Jeffrey.
Oh, so you're good at names, aren't you? To save the day, if you will.
Correct. We're really struggling through this.
Okay. While Chris is laughing, I mean, the intent of this comic, it's like an all ages thing.
Yes.
And I think like the best all ages comics should be for all ages and not just for kids. I mean, and it made me think on that topic of other all-ages books I've read. How do you think like this compares to... I guess Bone is usually thrown out as like a all-ages one in that it appeals to...
Yeah, I've heard even on the Facebook page that The Deep and Tom Taylor, as you kind of... There's comments like the parents are reading it to their kids, and that is that kind of book. I guess you'd have to be a certain age because a fair bit... I mean, it's 88 pages, so, I mean, obviously you'd read on a couple of pages before bedtime or whatever. I don't know. We don't have kids. We don't know how to interact with people younger than ourselves.
Sure.
But... But it is, it's a very good looking book, very easy on the eyes, and it's certainly, it's not a complicated story. And yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it, and I think this is something that I could probably hand to my, you know, nieces or nephews when they're older.
Yeah.
It is, it does, a lot of people, including myself, have said that it is kind of got that Pixar vibe about it, only because it's kind of got that loose animated feel, lovable characters, and kind of going on adventures and whatnot. Yeah, I liked it, and as you say, it is an all ages book, it's not a kiddie book.
Sure.
It's something that adults can certainly enjoy as well. And I enjoyed it. I did write a review on it for Broken Frontier a couple of weeks ago, just before it came out. So I'm trying to search my memory banks exactly what I said there. But I do remember that I liked it very much.
Okay. Well, if I'm being honest, it's probably a book I enjoyed less than you did.
Yes.
And it might not just be like an audience thing. I have some sort of, I guess, particular issues. I mean, as you mentioned, the style of it... with that kind of animated look, part of it, I get the impression that they were going for like a cross-media thing, that this could be very easily turned into an animated film. And even down to the art, the way it's drawn is the characters are drawn separately to the backgrounds and then superimposed over them. And the characters have that line definition while the background is the more painted kind of background art, in an animated film. So for me, that technique, while it would look great in an animated film, doesn't look... It doesn't seem to gel well for me on the page as a comic, and I kind of wish there was more clarity in the background as a cohesive, you know, as a page, as a piece of art. And yeah, the artwork, I mean, it's an intentional effect. The faces are very rubbery. They're very, it made me think expressive of Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah, cartoony.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it works for that all ages thing. They have to be fairly expressive. But I think the commercial look for it isn't going to appeal to everyone. And I guess maybe I'm one of those people. And I'm a fan of all of Gestalt's work, so I'm comparing it against that. So my standards are very high because I expect amazing things from them because they've more than delivered in the past. And Tom Taylor too, you know.
I see what you mean about the back. To be honest, I didn't really notice until you mentioned it. The backgrounds are non-existent, but to be honest, this doesn't take place in, gigantic Star Wars cityscapes.
Well,
it's on ice and undersea and...
Well, even in shots inside their ship, I think there was maybe, I'd say, more of a missed opportunity to add a bit of...
Like technical detail. And,
yeah, like texture. I mean, here there's a scene within the father's library, and it's basically, it looks like wallpaper on the back wall of these books to make it look like a library inside his... Like, there, I think maybe, I'd say more it's a missed opportunity to make their ship or their submarine look amazing from the inside.
Yep.
And okay. I mean, in warm-up to this book, I think I read an interview of Tom where he said how much research he was doing and so forth, and I guess I didn't really feel that as much on the page compared to, I'm sure he soaked it all in, but it didn't really translate into the comic. And right at the beginning, they quote an urban legend about fish memory.
Yeah, so I didn't realise that until you said something, so I wikied it, and yes, you're right.
It's one of those things like... humans only use 10% of their brain, which is also just something that was made up, and they think it started with like a TV commercial, and they're not sure. And people just take it as truth because it sounds truthy.
Yes.
It's got a degree of truthiness, as Colbert might say. But like for me, it's that sort of thing pulls me out of believing that these people are experienced.
So to clarify, the goldfish...
of course.
Memory, they have like about a 3-second memory or whatever. So every time they go around the bowl, it's like, oh, that's a new rock. Oh, that's a new rock. You know, it was in Finding Nemo as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Ellen DeGeneres. But that wasn't a goldfish.
No, she was a different type of fish.
Flounder or something.
Yeah, some dumb fish.
Yeah, apparently they have like a 3-month memory or something.
Yeah,
learn colours and shapes. And
yeah, they remember prey types for months, so they know to avoid a certain type of fish for 5 months, you know. As they say up to 5 months, so it's clearly... They do have memory wipes, but I guess the thing is the kid's trying to teach his fish to fetch and the daughter's being a wisecracking teenager. So,
Well,
Sif, bro, he'll never learn to fetch, bro. No, she doesn't talk like that.
The book kind of adds on a cliffhanger, and I think, you know, maybe Jeffrey will learn some tricks there. But, I mean, goldfish can be taught, apparently, so I guess that's what he's doing. But, so maybe Jeffrey will, you know, have some, you know, show up in like a big mechanized suit with a big gigantic water pistol.
That sounds familiar.
Taking out the bad guys, really?
Is that Earthworm Jim?
Oh, maybe.
Didn't the goldfish villain have like a suit that he walked around in?
See, I'm older than you, so I don't really have Earthworm Jim.
I thought you were just quoting Earthworm Jim stuff. Oh, I'm like, oh, Chris, you're so cool. But you're not.
That's what it takes.
I mean, okay, like just as, it's not so much on this comic now, but like say as a general all ages comics, I mean, there's sort of, I've noticed there's two kind of different classes. There's ones which are like, hey kids, this is the world and it's way more amazing than you can even understand at this age. Like think of your experiences of watching Star Trek as a kid, you know? And, like, a lot of the science fiction stuff in there isn't just made up. It's ideas that are plausible. And then there's, like, fantasy stuff.
Like Doctor Who.
Yeah, like Doctor Who or, I don't know. Like, the note I made here was, I was just thinking of some research. Say, Carl Barks' Donald Duck, which is another kind of classic all-ages comic. And they did a few aquatically themed episodes, and in one called The Sunken Yacht from 1949, he put in, you know, some reasonable real science in it. He actually, Karl Barks, invented a method that actually works of raising sunken yachts by pumping ping pong balls into them.
Yes, which they did on a Mythbusters episode.
Yeah.
And yeah, it does work.
And it makes perfect scientific sense, and I kind of like those moments of, God, science is amazing. And I guess...
Tintin would be like that, wouldn't it?
Not so much the science stuff.
Okay.
But, yeah, like the adventure and amazingness in the real world, and I guess I was maybe lacking that from The Deep.
I guess if there is going to be a continuation of this of the series, the cast is relatively small and it doesn't have a massive scope. It's mainly the family members are pretty much on every page, so it's mainly about them and introducing us to the Nexon family.
Sure,
it's kind of like a pilot, I guess, for a TV series, and then perhaps adventures would go on from there.
Yeah, it does feel like a first episode of an animated series or something, doesn't it?
It does, but not in a way that we've been duped or gypped in any way. It's still a satisfying and done in one adventure.
It sounds like I'm kind of nitpicking, but it's kind of like I think Tom Taylor's and Gestalt's work, they're experienced enough that they can handle it, you know?
Sure.
And they've put out so much great work that, for me, this sort of ranks somewhere in the middle, maybe. I don't know. It's not their best stuff for me.
I liked it more than you, but
The one thing I noticed right at the back, there's some character sketches, and I wish the comic had looked like this. They've done them in like a painterly style
more
without
of a
the
rounded kind of.
Yeah, they look more
3D-ish.
Yeah, less animated and more like something I could see in a comic or a storybook or something. And it's something that only makes sense to you when you see the comic. But that's just a difference in maybe what I like in comic art and what I expect from it. I mean, yeah. Script work. I mean, Tom, we know Tom's a great scripter. We'll be talking about Star Wars Invasion, I think, in our Star Wars episode.
We will next month.
Yeah, that's right. But I noticed little things like the kids all talk like pop culture enriched children, you know, even though they live in a submarine with their parents.
Yeah, that's true. They may not be if they're traveling the world underwater or whatever.
Yeah, that's right. They seem like they've seen every episode of Jersey Shore and... You know.
No, that's child abuse.
Yeah, it is actually. That's a terrible show.
I haven't seen any of it.
It's. I know we're leaving the deep here and going on to Jersey Shore.
But Shore Deep.
Very good. Maybe there'll be a crossover. Who knows? But I think, I think that's potential in this comic. And I'll be curious to see where it goes.
I can see a series of books starring these characters. I would be curious to see more bigger stuff happen in future installments, which I'd imagine, judging by the last page, would happen. So, I hope the Necton family return. And I'm always happy to see all ages books because there aren't enough these days. Though there is quite a resurgence in the last couple of years, as publishers have realised.
Not just children's books, but all ages books is what you're getting.
When I was in King's Comics, they said that's a big part of their market. You know, parents coming in with their kids and they have like an all-ages section, Sonic the Hedgehog and Mega Man, Archie, those are just like perennial bestsellers.
Sure.
So there's definitely a market out there. And for someone, this will be their first comic. And there's just very few comics that parents can read with or to their kids as well, I'd imagine.
Mm. So mild recommendation or recommendation?
I'd heartily recommend it.
Very good. I'd give it, I think if they put more kind of underwater sciencey stuff in the next one, I would heartily recommend that. But for me, it's maybe only a mild recommendation.
Okay.
All right. And a comic which I would not recommend to your children as their first ever
or last
is Alan Moore's continuation of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Now, there's a long wait between these comics being released, being scripted, Kevin O'Neill doing the art. So it's not like I've always felt this comic should have just been like an ongoing comic series with a rotating roster of artists. So, you know, I'd love to see Tony Millionaire do like a different art, like say the 1710s league. You know, different centuries and different periods should have different artists. But I guess what they've done here is instead they've stayed with that team, which is there's a long gap between these comics and there's a lot of anticipation, one could say.
I don't know why it's taking so long. I was just thinking about that this morning because the last one came out, 2 years ago? And the next one is supposed to come out, or was supposed to come out in 2009.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin O'Neill, I mean, his art isn't that detailed, so I don't know. Let's give a better background. So this is League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. The characters have been around since 1999, originally published by Wildstorm, DC
The characters
Comics.
Have been around longer than that, my friend.
That is true. So basically, when Alan Moore, Watchmen v Vendetta, when he originally pitched it, it was kind of the Justice League of the Victorian era.
Yes.
And I think the original name was the League of Extraordinary Gentlefolk, F-A-L-K.
Sounds like Amish or something.
But he changed it. So the first one came out in 1999. There was a film, Sean Connery's last film, out in 2003.
Wow.
Which is Americanized.
What a legacy. A
whole bunch of different characters in there. I actually quite find the film quite enjoyable.
The film is a funny animal.
It's nothing like the comics, really. But I
love the addition of
Tom Sawyer.
Tom Sawyer. I thought that was perfect.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I thought
it's just the Americans trying to, what they always do.
Well, it's an American film. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But enough about the film. This is about the comics. And I mean, as you mentioned, the Victorian era. There was a sequel to that, which was like...
So there was two books.
They
and then the Black Dossier, and then Alamore split with DC after his many feuds with them. So it's been published through Top Shelf and Knockabout Productions since. And the last, so I think Century.
There's been like a whole kerfuffle with publishers. I think Black Dossier came out on America's Best Publishing and...
Yeah, then there's different rights with some of the characters.
Yes.
With England, there was issues. So it came out in England before it was allowed to be legally released in America or something.
Right.
But yeah, the newest and I think the final three-issue miniseries is called Century.
Mm-hmm.
The first issue of Century was set in 1910.
Yeah.
And that came out, I think about 2 years ago. This is the second one, set in the year of 1969, which is quite an interesting time period. The third one was meant to be set in modern day, which is 2009. And obviously, it still hasn't come out yet, but when it does come out, it's still going to be set in 2009.
Right.
So
the modern day, you mean, like Back to the Future's modern day?
Yeah, playing cars. And, what else did he have?
I was thinking, like, the modern day of the second film was like, already 4 years ago. You know, when modern audiences saw it. So when he goes, oh, finally, I'm back in modern day.
Yes.
Where's he from? Not San Dimas. That's Bill and Ted.
Yes. One of them.
Hill Valley, sorry.
Oh, yes.
I'm terrible at this.
I'll be honest, when I was flicking through this, I expected to hate it. Because I think each book has got successively worse.
Yeah.
Like the first one... I guess I have fond memories of the first one because it was so eye-opening, especially for me. I didn't read it when it first came out, but later my brother's a comic geek like me, actually picked it up at the library.
Sure.
And we were both reading it, and it's got some pretty hardcore stuff in there, very adult-oriented, and then each one has got just more and more degraded and stuff that Robert Crumb would be blushing over, I think.
Yeah.
They're just less likable.
There's also less plot. In all of them.
But it seems to be complex, even though not much happens.
Yeah.
Well, it just throws so much at the page.
I noticed that especially, I reread Black Dossier just for this episode, and the whole plot of the actual comic portion of that is they steal the Black Dossier and then they escape. And then they go to the Blazing World and there's no more plot. So that's it. And then it's kind of like a vehicle for Alan Moore to hang all these little short stories he wanted to write. Set in like, he wanted to write a William Shakespeare play with characters called Piss and Shit, you know? And that's what getting on what you said, where it's becoming more and more, I don't want to say debauched, but it's true, isn't it? Like more and more openly perverse. And that's something that's always felt wrong about these comics is that his method is take these established characters, twist them to that they're not actually acting like they do in their original books and just make them all filthy perverts. It's like his vision of all these authors is they're all just filthy perverts, really, and they're just not open as me to writing these filthy stories. So really all they wanted to write was Mina Harker, you know, screwing a dragon. Or that doesn't happen, but you can imagine. Yeah.
We should point out some of these characters are. So the first one we've had, basically he takes characters that are in the public domain, most of them, and then kind of puts them all in together. So we had Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, we had the Invisible Man. But the main characters are Alan Quatermain from King Solomon's Mines, and as you mentioned, Mina Harker, who I think, was she played by Winona Ryder in the Keanu Reeves' Bram Stoker Dracula movie?
Not in the league, my friend.
So she's like a British woman who kind of gets ravaged. And so Alan Quatermain and Harker are now basically immortal, so they've been the main characters throughout all of the books so far.
Yeah. He's done something different by changing the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen into other time periods. So it's ceased to become telling these action stories in a period, and now having these characters from this very strict, uptight period thrown into like the debauched, you know, 1969.
Free love, peace, sex, drugs everywhere. I didn't feel he did as much as that as he could have.
Yeah.
Like, she gets a bit upset and offended when someone calls her an old Victorian woman or whatever.
Yeah.
But they didn't go far. Like, I guess they're just kind of immortal characters now, and they've been around for a couple of centuries. So they
And in the third character, which makes up this tiny, tiny league, is Orlando, which is a gender-bending character. I think it's not Virginia Woolf, is it?
No, it was in a movie as well. Yeah, she's the... it's something
that's
like
wrong.
That. It's, she basically... Google it, Melanie.
Yeah,
she basically wakes up as a man one day or something. It's like one of those classic novels.
But that was about, like, feminism and, the original novel was kind of an allegory for, you know, changing men's and women's rights at the turn of the century. So he decided, no, this character has been alive for millennia. So it seems very little like the original character. And at this point, it doesn't really matter because Alan and Orlando do nothing in this comic.
Well, if you open the first page, this is the first and hopefully only time that I'll ever see this on a first page of a comic.
Mm.
But
there's a dude blowing a dude.
Correct.
And in Alan Moore's style, he mentions their names, and I guess he's either assuming... It's the problem with this one, and it's become more and more prevalent as every volume goes on. He doesn't bother to explain who these people are.
No, and it actually took me a while to... Like, on the first page, you've got a penis staring at you on the face and two guys in a bathhouse. It kind of reminded me of that scene from Coming to America. The little penis is washed, Your Highness.
Oh, yeah.
But not as funny and much more disturbing. So right off the bat, I was like, Alan Moore, he's back, he's doing his, what he always does. And yeah, you're right, it wasn't until a few pages in that I didn't realise who was who, because the characters look quite different here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're in different clothes, they're in periods of the time.
Yeah. I mean, I've likened this to, I was telling Chris about it before, it's like Family Guy at a point.
Yes.
Where he's built this whole world around references to things that he considers the kind of fabric of pop culture in his mind, and especially English pop culture, not so much American or anything else. It's really focused on England and its creations. That's why there's no Tom Sawyer in this comic.
Yes.
And maybe that makes it harder for us as over here in Australia, and I'm sure Americans have the same problem. And there's little references here. I like, it is kind of fun when you pick out one and you go, oh, I know that one. There was a reference to Wild in the Streets, which is like it's a film you probably haven't seen, but it's this about 69 film where they lower the legal voting age to like 16 or 14. So this rock star gets in power, and they mention the American president has all the adults in internment camps, and that's his name. I'm like, that's that guy.
Oh, okay.
But I realized that was only fun for me,
yeah,
and not for anyone else.
I mean, Michael Caine is in here. That's an obvious one.
As Get Carter. That's not his name.
As what?
As Get Carter. The character Get from Get Carter.
and the Ruttles. Are you familiar with the Ruttles?
No, not
they're
at all.
Well, they're mentioned here. The Ruttles is a parody of the Beatles that Eric Idle from Monty Python did.
Yeah.
They did like a movie and a couple of songs. And I think they've actually released a few albums as well with, I think his name's Neil McInnes, who did the music for all the Monty Python films and stuff. So the Ruttles are in here. And there's characters in the background and stuff that look out of place that I'm thinking, I'm sure that's like a character from a newspaper strip.
The dude with robot arms, he's somebody, you know.
Yeah. It is very English, but the plot's fairly simple.
They're kind of on the trail of this occultist, Oliver Haddo, who's been sort of transferring bodies, and they think it has something to do with the birth of a new Antichrist. And really, it's a whole mix-up with these different plot elements of this murdered rock star, and it all has to do with the cult trying to find a new body for Oliver.
Yeah, there's this Mick Jagger type archetype character who wants to usher in this demon. So we can kind of live forever, and there's like a tribute concert to their dead
friend. And all the rock stars are former like schoolboy characters from the 50s, I think. I looked these characters up because really the book doesn't do anything to give you any assistance.
And if you've never read any League of Extraordinary Gentlemen book before, don't bother even looking at this.
The painful part of this is he's using these three main characters who are totally meaningless to you if you haven't read any of the previous books.
Yeah.
You can get the dynamic of their relationship, but it's so thoroughly, I don't want to say uninteresting, but it's because he changed the spirit of the original books, which was, you know, using these recognizable characters. Now he's not even bothering. It's like, these are now my characters. I've changed them enough that they're nothing like what they originally were like. Mina Harker is absolutely nothing like she is in Dracula.
But you could be said that after living for a couple of centuries, her personality would change.
And I guess that's what he's going for.
Yeah.
And
there's lots of sighing in this review.
There really is. And it's a hard book to comment on because the plot is so flimsy and it's just a way to mount kind of these references.
There's
on
lots
it.
Of sex everywhere. I mean, at one point I was going to count how many breasts and penises were in this comic.
You'd lose count,
but,
really.
Yeah, and there's lots of singing as there was in the last book as well.
I thought the singing was better integrated than
this
one.
It actually worked here. It looks like it's the... What's that Rolling Stones song about the devil. It looks like it's a play on that song where he's singing it.
I mean, I feel like I picked up on little things like a reference to King Crimson and other 60s music things. And I noticed in this volume, I guess the English influence on pop culture shifted from books onto music. So yes, this one uses music. There's references to a Jack Flash who jumped from a building, you know, and killed himself. You know, things like that.
Is that the Jumper Jack Flash Rolling Stones song?
Yeah, that's it. Okay. So, like, he's trying to play on music. There's little references to lyrics scattered throughout, so it feels familiar, like there's a man kicking in a jukebox, and you know that's a reference to a song. Someone kicking, like, it just feels like that's got to be a song reference, not a character.
Yes.
People doing stuff. But I guess that's what he's going for. The shift was from not so much writing and now onto music, and that was like the top literature of 1969, music and lyrics, you know? True. And the whole story revolves around this band. But it's, as you mentioned, all the references don't think they work anymore, and it's because he's trying to show off, like, you know, I've read all these things, isn't it cool, and you'll all enjoy these references, but he changes the characters so much that they're completely unrecognizable until someone tells you.
Yeah.
So it's like, I could do that. I could throw characters around and then go, look, I don't know who these guys are and you don't, but it's because I've stripped off all their clothes and they're scurrying like rabbits, and they would, you know, Mina Harker would have never done that in Dracula. She was such a prude in that, I seem to recall. I mean, as you mentioned, it's hard not to sigh about this.
It has such potential, and I think the first book will always be the best.
Yeah.
And it's just gone downhill after that. Kevin O'Neill's art, we haven't mentioned, is okay. It's very interesting. It's very loose and sketchy and not drawn in a kind of realistic way.
Yeah.
It's not cartoony, but it's very, a lot of hard edges everywhere. A lot of nudity. There's like an LSD acid trip here.
I'll say in this volume, I did not care for the art at all.
Everywhere.
Yeah. It's like all the previous volumes, his style has like a, it's like a 19th century engraving look.
Yeah, it's more of a rough-hewn kind of.
Yeah. And once you get into this kind of 60s look, he does a good job when he tries to emulate it, but it doesn't look right.
It needs something a bit more loose, organic.
Yeah, I wish he'd just gone for tried a different artist, and the books would be churned out quicker. And still, you know, he writes a big prose section at the back,
which neither of us read.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever get around to it. The prose sections tend to be the same, just jokes of, oh, here's Frankenstein, oh, he's having sex with something, you know. And I don't want to be too dismissive, because occasionally there's bits like, that's a great idea, or the way he's integrated this character into making that character make sense in a broader world is cool.
Yep.
Like, I mean, it's more obvious in the previous volumes, maybe because we recognized who the characters were, but the way he would make James Bond part of the same organization that was actually behind Big Brother, you know, and making Big Brother not occur in 1984, but in like 1920 when it was written, and like that kind of gelling of all these things to make a cohesive world, I thought really worked before, and now it's almost like we've seen you do it. Give us a good story set in this world that you've made.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
There's not much more to say. So I think we're both quite disappointed. Alan Moore is a good writer, but just he seems to be going the Frank Miller route in the last few years and just doing the same recycled ideas.
Yeah. Reusing other people's characters, writing them wrong.
Adding nudity doesn't make...
Rape. Rape in every single comic now.
Yes.
It's ceased to become like this... like device to shock. It's you expect it now.
Yeah.
I expect in every Alan Moore comic I read, there will be a rape or an attempted rape.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, Lord Voldemort tries to rape Mina Harker. Spoilers.
Lord Voldemort.
It is.
Is it?
Yeah. Okay. He does this kind of gymnastics throughout this book. The closer he gets to modern day, he can't reveal characters' names. So he has to refer to... well, he's called Tom Riddle at that point, isn't he? But the way he describes, oh, my first name's Tom, and my last name's a mystery.
Yes, now that you say that.
And I work in this college up north.
Yeah, now that image.
And like where they have classes in magic and witchcraft. And it's, okay, I get it now. And he gets the evil spirit in him.
Yeah.
That's a spoiler. Whoops. It doesn't matter. The plot's so flimsy. All of the volumes of Century and Black Dossier as well have been so far just they're on this quest, which turns out to not be important at all. and at the end just gets dissolved, or they don't have any influence in how it turns out. I think in this one, Get from Get Carter resolves the problem. But and then it's just like leading up to, oh no, it's all coming ahead. There'll be like a huge explosion at the end, and it's just like the opening chapter to like a big movie or something. It and if that last volume turns out to also be a disappointment,
yeah.
I'm sure Alan Moore fans won't care, but I'm already kind of done with this series.
Fair enough, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll buy the last one just to close the book on it, but yeah, disappointing. Don't bother.
Good. Agreed, yeah, don't bother with this one. Thus concludeth our review of Alan Moore. Sorry, Big Al. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Century Part 2, 1969. Long name, and there was some semicolons in there.
Great.
And also The Deep by Tom Taylor.
James Brower.
Thank you.
Brewer. Very good. So we don't know what we're doing next week, but hey, that's how we roll.
I'd like to just say thanks to everyone who's been commenting on the ES site and the Facebook. I think I was listening to another podcast. We shouldn't mention other podcasts, but they're a movie podcast, so it's fine. Battleship Pretension, and they were talking about how they can see that a lot of people are listening, like through the numbers, but they're like, why isn't anyone commenting? And I guess it might be because we're not throwing out questions to people.
Yep.
So if we asked you, hey, like, see, I've got to think of a question, something about Alan Moore,
What
do you think our question should be next week's
show? What do you think about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen? Do you think, like, the sex and the violence kind of ruins it? Do you think Alan Moore is past his prime?
Do you think he doesn't have a grasp of these characters?
Because I think Alex G is good for, say, uni students that are discussing, you know, 20th century literature or something. I'd imagine something like LXG would make it a bit more fun for them, perhaps.
Yeah.
Because obviously you get the references.
I think the 2009 one is going to have the most recognizable references, almost certainly.
I'm interested to see what he thinks about the internet and mobile phones and like how he's going to play with the modern tropes.
You have sex with them. Yeah, the internet will be a big porn joke for Alan. does Alan use the internet? Surely he does.
I don't think so.
Oh.
I don't think so.
In his castle.
Yeah. In the Highlands.
In the Highlands. I was trying to think of one of the towns from Lovecraft, but I can't remember now. Innsmouth. he has a castle in Innsmouth. There you go.
So, Facebook, jump on. Let us know what you think. We're also on iTunes and extrasequential.com. And
I want to know if people think Alan Moore's kind of lost it, if he's still writing good work, and whether you think we're just idiots for not getting his intellectual.
Well, we did discuss League in Vanity Projects.
Yeah.
And I think this is one of the prime examples where it's Alan Moore's name is still selling comics.
Yes.
Rather than his talent.
I'd still like to do that episode on whether creators should just quit while they're ahead or whether they should keep working until they're dried up husks with the occasional spark of, oh yeah, weren't they great? You know? I don't know. Maybe sometime. Maybe next week, maybe another week. We'll sort that out.
Thanks for listening as always. You can email us. It's Chris with a K at exodusequential.com. Comment on Facebook or on the website. My blog is Comic Book Jesus. And hopefully in the next week or so, I'll have a couple of articles about my Sydney trip up at Comic Book Resources, which is pretty exciting stuff. And Maladdin, what are you up to, apart from movie?
Music for the show is at Purge Audit. You can email questions and answers to Chris and just put, attention Maladdin, and he'll give them to me. I don't want to give out my personal email. Yeah, you are my secretary. You're going to weed out the threats and the...
the angry accusations.
Mail,
the love mail.
Yeah.
The ticking parcels. Well, you can't send a package to an email.
The package is covered in like a white powder. Okay. That's it.
Yeah, we're done. Thank you for listening. Speak to you next week.
See you
episode 54.